Hi there, it's Frank.
Hey. Hello, and welcome to A Roundabout Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Today, I'm speaking with Frank Tavares. You may be saying, Frank, who? Just listen. So we'll just go ahead and get started. You are a writer. You're a communications professor at Southern Connecticut State University. So you know the importance of opening lines in a story, and I just want to get your feedback on a couple of opening lines for this story right now. My first idea for an opening line when talking to you is, for three decades, Frank Tavares has been the most mysterious voice on NPR. My second idea is, Frank Tavares is the Iron Man of public broadcasting. Which one do you prefer?
Oh, the first one. I like the first one.
All right. As I said, for three decades, Frank has been the most mysterious voice on NPR. You probably don't recognize his name, but you do know his voice. You've heard him thousands and thousands of times on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. He's this guy.
Support comes from listeners just like you in Greater Chattanooga.
That's Frank, the support comes from guy. As you've probably noticed, he's not on NPR anymore. He recently retired. Today, we're going to find out what he's doing now. I'm going to talk with Frank about his decades of work on National Public Radio, and we'll talk about his other life as a fiction writer. His new collection of short stories is out. It's called The Man Who Built Boxes. Frank, welcome to A Roundabout Chattanooga.
Michael, it's my pleasure to join you. Thank you for having me.
You've done these underwriting credits since 1982. Why you? Why did they decide to get you instead of one of the hosts or one of the reporters doing underwriting?
I've often asked the same question over the years, especially when it was a week when something was not working quite right. Well, when NPR came up with the concept of having the funding credits, and originally they wanted the voices of the news programs to read the credits. And in the very beginning, they did when they were just simple credits like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or other nonprofit organizations. But then when they had a real commercial tilt, it just didn't seem right to have the hosts of the NPR news programs leaving a news piece and then reading this commercial copy. I'm putting commercial copy in quotes. You can see my little air quotes here. And so the concept was, well, we'll have a non-news voice do the funding credits, the sources of funding for particular programs. And the idea was is this would be a firewall between the content of the programs, the news programs, and the underwriting support. And at the time, I was hosting a couple of programs at NPR. I was at NPR and headed one of three different programming departments there. But the programs that I was heard on were not considered quote-unquote news programs, so I was a neutral voice. And the producer who was tasked with the project of pulling this together basically asked me to come into the studio one day. And my joke for years was I just happened to be walking past the door when she opened it, and she grabbed me by the collar and pulled me in. Not quite like that, but obviously something was working there. And up until September, Wendy Blair is the producer, or was the producer. We had worked together doing this, even after I left my full-time job at NPR and came up to Connecticut to teach.
And so you have now retired from that. What's going on? Why did you decide to go ahead and stop doing the underwriting credits?
Well, I'm always careful how I talk about this.
Okay.
Because NPR has been so very, very good to me. That's the old Garrett Morris Saturday Night Live line that he used to use in some of the early sketches. Baseball been very, very good to me. NPR has been very, very good to me over the years. And how can I complain when a gig that goes on for 30-plus years comes to an end? Notice passive voice. I was retired.
Ah, yes.
I'm joking about it, but basically what happened is NPR decided that they wanted to bring the funding credit production totally in-house. And the way it had been working is they had a full-time producer there who was doing the funding credits, Wendy Blair. And I live in Connecticut, so I would record from up here. And they wanted to combine the two positions. And the idea behind it was that it may make things a little more efficient in terms of when you needed to turn around something very quickly. And of course, you're always looking at the number of positions that that you're allocating to a particular task. So I think that was the basic reason they decided to do that.
So you're recording in Connecticut, and it was actually being aired on NPR based out of Washington, D.C. And I understand you were recording at home in what sounds like one of the most interesting recording studios I've ever heard about.
Yes, I'm talking to you from there right now. As a matter of fact, it's a good sized walk-in closet, which actually is an excellent place to record from, because you've got the clothes hanging around you. There's carpet on the floor. I do have a desk in the corner at an angle. There's carpet on top of the desk, so it's not a reflective surface. I have on the open spaces on the wall, I have cloth-covered foam. So it's really a very good dead space, and it works well for recording. What I actually didn't record them here. I voiced them here, and they were actually recorded in one of the studios or recording spaces at NPR in Washington. So it was really cool. So I would, when it was time to do something, I would sit in front of the microphone, I would turn everything on, and I would sit there, and through the magic of master control at NPR in Washington, all of a sudden I would hear the producer's voice in my earphones, and she would hear me. And it was as if, in the very beginning, Mike, I was worried that it would be really strange not seeing her through the glass.
Yeah.
It took about 30 seconds. And she was there, I could hear her, and it was not a problem. And I had the scripts in front of me, which I would get on Excel spreadsheets and just go through them one after the other after the other. So it was really, it worked quite well. And the quality of it in terms of the type of microphone we were using and the special line we were using was just super. Except when my next door neighbor was mowing his backyard. So what we would do, this is true and it worked. What we would do is I had a little sign I would put in my office window, which is on that side of the house, to let him know that I was recording. And he was just really nice. So he started mowing his lawn on Thursday evenings instead of Saturday mornings when we normally were recording.
And I've heard that you would record like batches of hundreds at a time, which is why I would call you the Iron Man of public broadcasting.
Well, that's true. Each one of those little individual credits that you hear like at the end of the newscasts, they run around 10 and a half seconds. And sometimes you change the preamble to control the time a little better. And then you have them often in groups of three or four. But the individual ones in our normal recording sessions, which were every other Saturday, we would do somewhere around 500 or 600 of them. Just back to back to back to back to back. And then I got to, when we finished, the producer and I would chat for a minute and I'd wish her well and I'd go off and have lunch. And then she had to go through and listen to them all again as she was putting them in different files. And she was the iron person. That. And then in between any type of emergencies and so forth, if there was a word change or a website change or whatnot, I could, I'm about 20 minutes away from home when I'm at work, so I'd run home between classes and we could fix any problems that might come up. The only challenge sometimes was when I was traveling, and so I would carry a list of stations, and if I was traveling in the Chattanooga area, you would have gotten a call from me or the producer, hey, you know,
yeah,
can we steal a little studio time? Actually, I shouldn't say that because NPR always paid for it.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I would pop in and they would send the stuff down and I would record it and nobody would ever know.
You're just joining us. I'm talking to Frank Tavares, the voice of NPR because of his years of recording underwriting credits for NPR. But Frank, you're also a fiction writer. Your short stories have appeared in literary journals and magazines, and last year, your first short story collection came out. It's called The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories. I'd say it's kind of a mix of literary fiction, crime fiction, some magic realism, a little bit of horror. Who is the audience for The Man Who Built Boxes?
Well, just from your description, I'm going to run right out and buy a copy. Well, that's a good question, because you always worry about that as a writer. Who's the audience? Well, maybe I should back up a little bit. I mean, the first audience for any of my fiction has always been me, and I started writing fiction a number of years ago, primarily because I just enjoyed it. It gives you the illusion, Mike, of being able to control something.
Yeah.
You know, as a writer. And then I started, well, I've been writing my whole professional life, but the fiction started probably 15 years or so ago. And I started sending stories to different literary journals, and you have a certain affirmation when somebody else outside of your immediate friends and family looks at something and likes it enough that they want to publish it. And I found that affirmation was really rather addictive, maybe a little too strong, but it certainly felt good. And that motivated me to write more. And how you introduce the different types of stories, what I found is that, and that was a challenge when we were putting together these things, because the stories fall into little mini genres in some cases. And a lot of that just depended on where I was at the time, what idea I had for a story. And sometimes I would start with just a single line. In some cases, I started with a title or an experience I had, and it's an old thing. You hear writers talk about this all the time, and when I used to interview people, I always wondered about it. But the characters sometimes take you in directions that are unexpected and really rather fun. So yes, some of these things are a little more mystery. Some of them are well, you used the word horror. I hadn't thought of that before, but yet, yeah, there was one story in there. Max Rylan meets the devil.
That's the one.
I'm thinking, yeah, I would be horrified by that experience. So I'm enjoying your characterizations of them. Thank you.
We are just about out of time. How can people find the book, The Man Who Built Boxes? Do you have a website?
TheManWhoBuiltBoxes.com. Will take you right to the site, and there's background material on the book and places where it can be bought, and some other interesting snippets and reviews and the like. And it seems to be doing it seems to be fairly well received. So again, that's affirming, and that's pushing me to write more.
One of the standout stories, in my opinion, in the short story collection is Girl in a Box. It's about a guy who literally orders a girl in a box, like he's ordering a computer off Amazon or something. But no, it's a woman in a box, and she lives in the box. Tell us about that story a little bit.
It's I was having a conversation with someone once, and they about a mutual friend. And the person said, well, how would you describe this particular person? What do you see as their own personal hang-ups? And there are two main characters in that story, the guy and the girl. And I remember in my conversation with the person, and we were talking about a woman that we both know, and I said, well, she's very, very controlled and really protective of how she feels and doesn't really want to share much, and yet sometimes is disappointed because other people want to be involved in her life, but she really keeps them away. And I had this image of, you know, girl in the box. And that's how it started, just from this little snippet of conversation about our mutual friend. And so it started with the fellow coming home, and here's the box, you know, dropped off by whatever, UPS, sitting in his driveway. And it came to me fairly quickly that this would really work well, so I thought, if we had the story told in each of their voices. So the first half of the story is his perception of it, trying to get to know this person who's so protective of herself and trying to get a sense of what she's like and what she wants and what she expects and what she looks like. And so we go through all of that, and then we go through the exact same sequence of events, but from her point of view. So, which was actually challenging in a way. I mean, one of the very simple challenges was to make sure that the dialogue from his version and from her version was exactly word for word.
Yeah.
It sounds so simple, but when I was going through it, every time I would make a little change, because the secret of writing is rewriting, and so each one of these stories, and that particular one before it was published, probably had, certainly a dozen, 15 different rewrites on it. And every time I would make one little minor change in one section, it would take a couple of hours to kind of figure out how to work it into the other section. But that's where the idea for that came, and then I really just like the Gates of Rashomon type of aspect of it, where you're the same experience but from two very different points of view and different expectations and different realizations. And that was I never showed it, by the way, to our mutual friend, so I was afraid she might recognize herself, or maybe worse yet, wouldn't. And then
I think one of the interesting things about the story is you start out thinking, oh, this poor girl confined to a box. But then as you start to see things from her point of view, you get the idea that, no, she wants to be in the box. And kind of her source of power is deciding whether or not she wants to let people in the box. Were
exactly.
you conscious of that when you were writing it? Because it seems to make some really good points about being an introvert, for example, and being inside of a space, being inside your own head, being inside of a box, being confined. But you're not really confined. You choose to be there.
You're spot on. And that comes back to that where I talked about the being a writer, a fiction writer, gives you that illusion of control. Well, here's one of the characters that has this. And I would say illusion of control, or maybe the control, because certainly in the book she has the control. She makes all of the decisions. She does exactly what she wants to do, reveals as much of herself as she chooses, and then stops revealing when she chooses. And that's exactly where I was headed with that. And of course the fellow, and we hear his version of it first, is clueless.
Yeah.
Which I find is quite often true in real relationships. Speaking as a guy, so many times over my life, I realized, usually after the fact, that I was clueless. And it's always such a delicious revelation to oneself after an adventure or a relationship or years later when you go back and revisit something with a friend, when you realize, boy, I really was. But that's part of the fun of it, you know. That really is.
Some of the stories are really straight crime fiction, not necessarily mysteries, but in the crime genre, the kind of thing that might appear in Ellery Queen or Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Who are some of your influences? Are you much of a crime fiction fan?
I read a lot of different things, but I guess the easiest way for me to answer that question this is the best way, I think, for me to answer the question is, among the writers that I really enjoy reading, that I will go to the library or a bookstore and I will search for their books, one of them is Elmore Leonard,
oh, yeah.
who left us just this past year. And the reason why I find myself gravitating to his books, first of all, they're just great beach reads. I just enjoy them. I love his characters. They're always flawed. There's always a rough side to them, some unexpected aspect of them, where they're walking an ethical line. Sometimes they're aware of it, sometimes they're not. And that's something that I just found so real, even though many of the people Mike and Frank know perhaps wouldn't cross that line, as many of his characters do. But both of us know people that have those aspects to them, and we have, you know, the darker sides of our own personalities. And so I've always liked that. As a matter of fact, I've only mentioned this to a couple of people because this is one of the things that makes me seem like I'm really dumb. But why should I not confess that? Because I have my moments. When we were putting together the collection, the publisher of the book, this is way back last spring, and she was asking me who my favorite writers are or were, and Leonard was one of the ones up there along with several others. And she was, with her publisher's hat on, thinking, well, who could we get to do a little advanced blurb for the back of the book? And so she came back to me and she says, well, why don't you ask Elmore Leonard? And Mike, it scared me. I've never met him. I don't know him. And I didn't word it this way to her, but I'm thinking in my own, I couldn't, that would be so presumptuous, because what do I know about marketing and books and publishing, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, supposedly I know a lot about marketing. I used to be in the business, but when it's personal, it gets a little fun. So, long story short is I didn't ask him. And then I remember when I read that he had died several months later, it was one of those dope slap yourself moments. That why was I afraid? What was the worst thing that could have happened? He didn't respond to my note,
yeah.
Or he, you know, what was he going to do? Respond and tell me, you know, am I crazy? Or I, you know, and I'll never know. And maybe he would have. Maybe he would have been an NPR fan and would have loved to respond to this.
Yeah, you really never know. I mean, just as a journalist, I find a lot of times I'm trying to get an interview with somebody, and I think there's no way that person would talk to me. And if I just email them and ask, they say, yeah, sure, why not?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you would think that you know, we would know better by this particular time. And I found myself, you know, really stumbling over that. So lesson learned, and the next time I will not hesitate.
I want to play a clip from the Unger Report. This is from 2003. A reporter got you to read the lyrics to Welcome to the Jungle. Let's just hear a little clip of that.
Welcome to the jungle. We've got fun and games. We got everything you want, honey. We know the names. We are the people that can find whatever you may need. If you got the money, honey, we got your disease. In the jungle, welcome to the jungle. Watch it bring you to your knees. Knees. I want to watch you bleed.
See, this is why they warn us, Michael. This is why, you know, always consider the mic is live and you never know where it's going to end up. And once it's on the internet, it's always on the internet.
I mean, did you get a lot of requests like that? People going, oh, I love how you read that. Just read something really bizarre. I want to hear your voice saying something crazy.
It didn't happen a lot, but it did happen. And that particular piece was a part of the long gone NPR midday show called Day to Day, which was produced out of the NPR West in Los Angeles. And Brian Unger would do these regular pieces once a week, these really off the wall kind of things. And so I did a couple of different things for him over the years. And he came up with, I think that was the first time that we had worked together. And he said, okay, I've got a couple of these things I want you to read. And obviously that was one of them. And I'm game for stuff like that. The other thing that I used to like to do would show up every once in a while is when NPR would do the April 1st little phony stories.
Oh,
and
yeah.
All things considered, is the one of the producers would often pull me into that with bizarre funding credits or other strange things. Oh, I loved doing things like that. And then, yes, people at individual stations sometimes would call, we have an idea for doing this, you know, would you be game? And almost always, unless it would have been something that would not have worked well with the NPR brand.
Yeah.
Because I was very protective of that. But I also have a sense of humor. Yeah, that was fun. I'm so glad you found that piece.
Well, the voice that you have when you're doing those underwriting credits, how did you develop that? Because everyone says it's neutral, and that is the perfect word for it, because that's what you really want in an underwriting credit, is just a neutral, dispassionate voice. You're not promoting anything. You're just thanking a sponsor.
That was the idea behind it, that you didn't want one to jump out much more than one of the others, especially when you listen to them in the groups of three or four. And it just came with practice. And one of the things that I like doing this interview with you today is that some of the WUTC listeners will hear that I actually have a normal speaking voice.
Yeah.
And I have a sense of humor, and I can put inflection in it, and I can say words that have H in it without pronouncing the H's, which apparently would drive some NPR listeners nuts. Because the producer would often, and I didn't hit it all of the time, but she really liked me to put the H in where and the H in when, and which is not the way that Mike and Frank normally talk. But this is the producer, and when you're doing voiceover work, and it really comes down to this, you're a professional, and you do what the producer or the director asks you to do. And one of my examples of that, because this one. And I have to thank NPR for being a firewall between me and irate listeners in terms of what was said on the funding credits. But every once in a while, people would break through the funding wall and find me, and I would get an email at my university account or whatnot. Quite often, irate in regards to how I was pronouncing something. And I think the favorite one was for an organization and I'm forgetting the full funding credit, but it's Edutopia, 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 I think that's how it is. So we would say it, you would read this thing and you would say Edutopia. Well, it would show up twice in some of the funding credits. Support for NPR, blah, 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 Edutopia, a foundation, blah, 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 at edutopia.org. And I would pronounce it Edutopia, and then for the actual web address, I would say Edutopia. And of course, that's just crazy. But there were discussions about this.
They had meetings about this.
The second pronunciation, because it's part of the web address, and this is an unusual word that's not a real word, and this way nobody would be able to make a mistake in terms of. Typing in the correct letters. And so most of the time, that's what we did. Well, some people it just degraded the quality of their life. It was, and so I would, if something got to me, I would usually respond. And the way I would respond was, you know, thank you for your concern, and I really appreciate you being a supporter of NPR. And then I would tell them a little bit about it. This is why we do it, and most of the time that was fine. But it was so. I'm glad I could tell that story, because some of those listeners might be your listeners, and
oh,
now
I'm
they're
sure
sitting
they
back
are.
And they're saying, "Oh, I had no idea. Oh, Frank, I'm so sorry for what I was thinking." And well, you're welcome, and thank you.
Doing them in just these batches of hundreds at a time, I mean, how do you do that? Because me, if I have to read for more than 2 or 3 minutes, I need to stop. I need to drink some water. I need to maybe walk around a little bit.
It really is so much of it. Well, first of all, because I'd been doing it for so long, the first sessions we did were nowhere near those four-hour, half-day sessions. That's about how long they would take, usually around 4 hours. And we would take a break. Usually just to save the file to make sure that nothing was lost a couple of times during that session. But part of it is, and you know this from some of the work that you do too, is when you get into a groove, you don't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
You want to ride that wave as long as you can. And it would take me maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and then I would be in that groove, and we would just do one, and then the second, and then the third, and then the 122nd, and the 120, and just... I didn't like to lose that concentration, and part of it really was making sure that I had the right things to eat in the morning, so I would be able to get through the whole session. Drink a lot of water. You're absolutely right. Always had a couple of water bottles with me as we went through the session. I was very careful about what I would eat that might gum up the throat in the morning. I was careful about. Here I have two teenage boys in the house. Well, one is in college this semester, so I was always careful about conversations that I might have with them the evening before. I don't want to do anything that would mess up the voice. I'd start to obsess about the voice, actually. We recorded on Saturday. I'd start worrying about it on Wednesday. How many classes do I have? How much talking am I going to do? And I would make sure that that Friday I would do things that would nourish the voice and protect it rather than just the opposite. Because you're right, you know, and I would finish those four-hour sessions, those three-and-a-half, four-hour sessions sometimes. When you're on and you're in front of the mic and you're doing it, you're right there. And then we'd be done, and I know the files were saved and everything was okay, and would find myself just I would deflate, and it was like, I'm tired.
You're a professor at Connecticut State University, Southern Connecticut State University. Do you do a lot of work with students, teaching them to do voiceovers and giving them advice?
Actually, it's funny because I don't.
Wow.
I teach primarily in organizational communication, which deals with management communication, business communication, that type of thing. Some professional presentation, but nothing that really deals specifically with voice and voice work. And as I've been thinking about this recently because people have also asked me in conversation, well, have you ever thought about teaching fiction? And the idea of that strikes me the same way as teaching somebody how to use their voice. I don't have any idea how to teach somebody how to write fiction or how to use their voice. I can give them suggestions in terms of how to protect your voice and visualizing somebody that you're speaking to, that type of thing, but I don't know how to do it, as silly as that sounds, Michael.
Huh. So maybe you're self-taught?
I started radio work actually like many of us at a college station, and it was a funny thing. It was funny to me. We'll find out if it's funny to anybody else. But remember in high school when you were graduating and you had your yearbook and it's the last couple of days of class and you would pass it around and everybody would sign it, even people you didn't know very well. And there was a girl in one of my classes who signed it, and I knew her, but we weren't in the same group of pals. And she just wrote something simple, "Oh, with a voice like yours, you should be in radio," something which I had never, ever, ever thought about. Flash forward to that fall, and I'm a freshman at my college, and in the gymnasium, they have all of the campus organizations, and you're walking through and seeing what you can get involved in, and here's the one for the campus radio station. And I literally walked past it, and I remember thinking, oh, I remember what Marie said. And I go back, and that was, I have to track her down on Facebook,
yeah,
and tell her that it's her fault. But that's exactly how I got started. And the big problem for me was that I grew up in a part of the country where I had a very specific and definite accent. And where I was going to school was a different part of the country where they spoke very differently. So the challenge was, and this was a time when everybody needed to have in radio, regionalisms were not appreciated. So everybody tried to have that neutral voice. Maybe this is where the neutral stuff comes from. And so I worked very hard to, first of all, recognize my accent, which took me a number of weeks. I started recording everything that I was doing at the radio station, and then I could hear the accent. Oh, I see what they mean. Oh, it is me. It's not them. And then it took about the better part of a semester to get to the point where I could control it. Most of what I was doing on the air was reading scripts so I could practice it and manage not to to slip into the regionalism from my hometown. If I really wanted to poke you a little bit, I would ask you, although you probably know this already, where I grew up.
Well, I think in your bio it said Texas.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not, because you sound very new. I mean, like, I can't really detect any kind of an accent at all with you.
Well, okay, see, this is so much fun, isn't this? I lived in Texas for 5 years.
Okay.
When I was in grad school. But I'm a New Bedford, Massachusetts boy, 50 miles south of Boston. So I grew up Pachtika in the Harvard Yard.
Oh, wow.
And all of that. I still say if Mike and Frank go out and have a beer, I will still say, I still say this, actually, idea. Mike, I have a great idea. That's one I've never been able to lose. I have to work really hard on that. And it'll slip in every once in a while. It did in some of the funding credits when I would hear them playing back. Every once in a while, I would hear an R where there's not supposed to be an R. Or what I should say is every once in a while I would hear an ah when there's not supposed to be an ah. And other times I wouldn't hear the ah when there was supposed to be the ah.
That's interesting.
Yes, clicking clack's backyard.
Because, I don't hear that at all. But
thank you for saying that.
You're right, though, because now I think TV, particularly in the South, a lot of us, like I grew up here. I've lived in Chattanooga my entire life. And whenever I meet people for the first time, they always ask, where are you from? Like,
yes, exactly.
No, I'm from here, but I grew up watching TV. So I just kind of have this non-accent that I guess comes from TV.
Being in the media. And I would not, if you hadn't told me that you are a Chattanooga fella, I wouldn't have pegged that. My wife grew up in Tennessee and has a neutral accent, unless she's really tired, or sometimes she's talking to someone and making a real nice connection. I can hear some of the Tennessee accent, or what I think is her Tennessee accent, because it's different from how she normally talks. And I certainly don't hear it in you either. And I think you're onto something. I think a lot of it is from what we hear in the media, that kind of belief that neutral is better. And it was that way for so many years.
What about when she gets angry? Does it come out at all when she gets angry?
Oh, she never gets angry. interesting. Actually, now I have to stop and think about that. No, it's mostly, I think I hear a little bit of it, like with myself, when she's very tired.
Yeah.
That's when some will slip out. But she hasn't lived in Tennessee since she graduated from high school, so it has been. She's had other influences also on her voice. Accents are so interesting, aren't they, Michael?
Oh, I mean, yes.
It's really really fascinating to try to guess and hear the regional differences. And sometimes it'll just be a single word that'll peg it. Maybe not so much for me, but people who understand these things. I've always loved listening to interviews with. Linguists who can just peg, they have a couple of standard sentences that they'll ask somebody to read, and there are key words in there that they can tell, oh, this is Philadelphia, or this is Chattanooga, or this is New Haven, Connecticut. I mean, it just astounds me. But that's not my area of specialty, so I'm easily amused.
Well, like here in the South, you know, like people say the Southern accent. There is no the Southern accent. Just in Chattanooga, North Georgia, you'll find dozens of different accents around here.
Yes, and which is the same when you go into the Southwest. When I lived in Austin, you had a very different sense of the accent in Austin, people who were born and grew up in Austin. And if you went just a few miles out of town, you could hear a very different way of speaking, different emphasis on words. And, of course, the state was so large, well, still is. When you went to West Texas or East Texas, you would hear very different influences in terms of the regional aspects of it. Yeah, it's fascinating. And then the time I spent in Illinois, probably Illinois, because I went from New England to Illinois. I was out there for about 9 years and worked out there in commercial broadcasting as well as the college station. And then it was Texas, and then it was California in the San Joaquin Valley, which is also kind of neutral in speech. Then Washington, D.C., which is a whole book in itself, because you have people from so many different parts of the country coming there, and then back up to New England. So it's odd, and you probably have this experience too, is you can hear, if you know somebody's from a different part of the country, sometimes you'll hear those giveaway words with them, and
yes,
they are absolutely, totally unaware that they're pronouncing something a little different.
Well, Frank, it has been great talking with you. Your book is The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories. It's a short story collection. How can the listeners find it?
I think the easiest thing is to go to the manwhobuiltboxes.com website, and there are connections there for several different sources for the book, and also different reviews, things that are very affirming when they're positive reviews for any writer.
It's out in paperback right now. Do you have any plans to record an audiobook?
I've been thinking about that. Time for one story?
Yes.
Not a story from the book, but one of the stories that's in this collection Well, it's the neighbors. It's the third story, I think, that's in the book. When that was published, the editor of that particular literary journal asked me if I'd be willing to read that for their website. And my first reaction was, oh, absolutely, of course, I'd be glad to do that. And then, as I thought about it over the next couple of days, it occurred to me that, now, these are my characters, and the voices all come from my subconscious. I understand all of this stuff. I really do. But the two main characters in that book are very, very profane, and I'm not. You know, in their language. And I realized I don't know if I would be comfortable reading that.
Wow.
And certainly not as the voice of NPR, because part of it is protecting the brand. And so I talked with a couple of my NPR pals, and I said, look, I'm just thinking about this. What's your take on this? And I heard from a couple of them, basically, they said, well, you know, with the Internet, absolutely somebody's going to find the connection. Oh, the voice of NPR is reading this thing where these characters are, they're returned Iraqi war vets. And both of them are not without their problems, and even with the humor and so forth that is in that story, the language is really rather. One reviewer referred to it as salty, and so my two different NPR pals said, well, you know, probably fine, it's okay, but yeah, somebody's going to make the connection, and there might be a little chatter about this thing, and so I decided I can't do this. All right, I like I say, protect the brand.
Well,
so
yeah.
I let the editor of the journal know that I changed my mind and offered him something else that I would do instead. And it's not that I'm against particular words. You can cover them and you can read around them, and that's okay. But it's just that these two characters, it was almost in every sentence. And so all of that, you asked me, have I thought of doing an audio version of the book? The answer is yes, but I haven't decided yet.
Well, I think worst case scenario would be like somebody taking you reading these very profane words and then taking some audio of you reading underwriting credits and mashing them up together and putting it on YouTube.
You're brilliant. I knew I liked Michael Edward Miller.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. It has been great talking with you, finally getting to know the guy who's done all these credits all these years.
Michael, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.